The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Medievalist. Today, October 18th, 2009, is my 38th birthday. And I can really consider no more appropriate way of celebrating this festival occasion than by discussing the topic that we're going to deal with today, and that is none other than the organization and institutions of the Ukrainian Cossack movement and community. The Cossacks are a group of people who are often commented upon. They're often admired. But unfortunately, there are not many things known about them, at least as far as general knowledge is concerned. And in this show, hopefully I am going to solve that problem. I want to say that the Cossacks represent everything good and everything powerful, everything just about Ukrainian society, especially in the period of time that we're talking about in the 17th and 18th century. Of course, the end of the 18th century, under the reign of Catherine II, the Cossacks will be largely eliminated and drafted completely into the all-Russian armed forces. But up until that period of time, the Cossacks are a group of people, I think, that we can admire, and that in understanding them and coming to comprehend the way that they live their lives, we ourselves might be able to improve and understand, to some extent anyway, really the nature of justice and how society should be run. We need to remember, first of all, that the Cossack society was never a dictatorship. There was never a time in Cossack society where there was ever really authoritarian rule, with the exception of those times of severe national stress and strain. The main legislative authority, and even to some extent the main executive authority, of the Cossack forces is the General Council, that meets periodically in wherever the Cossack capital happens to be. All of these posts, from the hetman or the head or monarch of the Cossack forces to the membership of the General Council, as well as the local councils, these are all elected. These are all elected positions, but there is one problem, and there's one problem we have to talk about, and it's come up again and again, and that is a class structure. And this class structure is something that is inherent in really any society, is something inherent in Cossack society, but it's made slightly more obnoxious by the fact that Russian agents, particularly in the 1600s and the very early 1700s, are engaged in exacerbating the divisions between rich, middle, and poor Cossack units and forces throughout Ukrainian territory. The Ottoman, or the monarch of the constitutional monarch of the Cossack forces, wherever they might be, is elected by this General Council. Now, there have been cases, in the case of Khmelnytsky and Mazepa, where there has been a desire to create a hereditary monarch, not so much because they hated, you know, democracy, but because that hereditary monarch would strengthen the institution of the central authority and permit the Cossacks to be more effective and more unified against the Russians or the Poles or the Turks or whoever their enemies happen to be. But in general, throughout Cossack history, not only are the members of the General Council, but also the Ataman and the Hetman themselves are also elected. These are all elected positions. It might be said, and I don't want to exaggerate this really, but it might be said that the Hetman is advised by a General Council and elected by a General Council that forms a lower house, and yet there is a an upper house called the Council of Elders. Now, I know I'm importing kind of, you know, Western ideas of upper and lower house into the Cossack world, but to some extent they operated in the same way. And so that's your basic central organization. Wherever the capital happens to be, you have a general council, and then you have a council of elders that both elect and advise the hetman or ataman, actual monarch, the constitutional monarch of all Cossack forces within the jurisdiction of the particular group. And there are numbers of these centers throughout history. There isn't just one of them. They exist throughout Turkish, Polish, and even in Russian territory consistently. But nevertheless, they generally hold to this basic institutional structure. Now, the Cossack forces also function as local bodies beneath and inferior to the central institutions, and that these are led by colonels. And all of these colonels are also elected by the local body. So the local formations of the Cossacks directly under the Ataman hold the rank of colonel. The head of these institutions hold the rank of colonel. So you have this general, somewhat centralized organization, but the Russians slowly but surely attempt to dismantle the system. And they do it by a few ways. They do it by exacerbating class differences amongst these institutions, but they also do it by setting one faction off against another. So what you have among the Cossacks is quite an advanced, substantial, and workable constitutional system. And I want to make it clear, I know in the last few talks that we've had on this program, you've had a move, including by the very famous Hetman Doroshenko, to go to the Turks. But, you know, although the Turks have very little in common with the Cossacks, the fact is the Turks realized that this constitutional structure is something very important to the Cossack movement. And of all the different groups competing for Cossack loyalty, the end of the 1600s, beginning of the 1700s, the Turks were the most adamant about saying that we will maintain the traditional Cossack constitution. And this is the reason why you had such a movement of people willing to go to the Turks and willing to give loyalty, political, of course, not religious, political loyalty to the Turks, because they didn't trust the Poles or the Russians in this respect, that they would not maintain and support the traditional Cossack constitutional system. Now, the class divisions in the Cossack world will be their downfall. It's unfortunate, but it's fact. Generally speaking, the class divisions of the Cossacks look something like this. At your very highest level, you have your high Cossacks, those with a lot of land, those with a lot of cattle, those with a tremendous amount of power. You have lower Cossacks that have less of all of these things. But then you have a non-Cossack element still of some substance called the country aristocracy or the country gentry. Under them come the towns. The townsmen who generally deal with trade and money matters. And then under them, you have the peasants and the clergy. I also want to make a point that the old believers of Russia, who we've dealt with on this program many, many times, have really found a home in Ukraine, and that the old believers are an integral part of the merchant life of the Ukrainian point of view. And I want to say that the old believers had a tremendous influence on Ukrainian life, and they had a tremendous influence on the development of the liturgical and prayer life of the Ukrainian people. Now, the constitutional structure of the Cossack forces really comes from all over the place. It is a composite movement. It comes from, to some extent, Russia and Poland. It comes from Turkey. The towns are dictated by the Magdeburg Law. It comes from the Lithuanian statutes. And really, over the years, over the centuries, the Cossack constitutional idea really derives from all over Central Europe. At its height, the Cossack armed forces, taken together, number between 200 and 300,000 armed and trained warriors. And when I say at its height, what I kind of really mean are those periods of time where the Cossacks are involved in substantial campaigns. They're divided up into regiments of roughly 5,000 people, and then those regiments are themselves divided into centuries of 100 people. Each regiment of 5,000 men maintains and has to train about 10 or 15 crews to handle the cannon and the artillery. So that's your basic structure of the Cossack forces at the beginning of the 1700s. And what they're trying to do is really, they're trying to synthesize the ideas of central authority with the classic national and religious anarchist idea of the Cossack world. But given the fact that they are surrounded by enemies, the Cossacks cannot function on anarchist principles. They really have to organize some loosely kind of constitutional society. Now, the laws that are passed by the General Assembly and the Assembly of Elders are to be interpreted purely autonomously by the local level, by the local colonels, who, by the way, also run the local district courts. And the colonels who exist in every major Ukrainian town, who command a great number of Ukrainian warriors, these are people who are chosen. They're elected, of course, like all Ukrainian politicians are elected. Elected based largely on their fighting skill and their record in the field. They are the ones who are in charge of interpreting the laws that come down from the capital. They are the ones that apply these laws in the court system. But in 1734, with some Russian assistance, there is this idea that the system needs to be streamlined. In the 1730s, the Cossack autonomy is slowly being wiped away, and it's only a generation later before the Cossacks are eliminated as an independent and autonomous part of the Slavic Orthodox world. Prior to that, you have something that the Cossacks live by called the Bendedi Constitution, approved in 1710. It is something that is respected by other European powers, and it is based on a series of concepts. Number one, the independence of the Ukrainian peoples. That Ukraine is different from Russia and Poland and everywhere else. And so the Bendedi Constitution is something that maintains Ukraine as a national autonomous entity. Number two, that it is based on an elected monarchy. That monarchy is important. To have a single source of leadership and authority is absolutely important, especially during wartime. But this monarchy is always to be elected. That the Cossacks as an organization are the chief class in Ukraine. They are the chief class in terms of maintaining and supporting Ukrainian independence and military operations. And that the idea of Soborno Pravane, the idea that the council, that the synod exists on every level, from the family all the way up to the hetman himself, is the dominant organization, the dominant way that society functions. And lastly, and more abstractly, the Bendedi Constitution of 1710 holds that it is not Russia, whether it be Moscow or St. Petersburg, that comes from the ancient civilization of Kiev, but it is the Cossacks and Ukraine that come from the ancient civilization of Kiev. This is something, I think, more than anything else, that we should really consider, because it is a statement of national identification. The idea that Kievan Rus is a real historical entity, and that it's only true successors are to be found in the Cossack organization. And they have a very good reason for holding to this view, because the old Kievan understanding manifests a synthesis between aristocracy, monarchy, and democracy, as well as a strong devotion to trading and the towns. And this is something that the Cossacks maintain scrupulously throughout their history. So there is every reason to believe that this claim in the Bendedi Constitution makes every bit of sense. And that, in fact, the Cossacks are the successors of Kievan Rus, not Russia, not Poland, not Lithuania, but the Cossack forces and the Cossack units. All right, so for the rest of this talk, we're going to deal with the different institutions and their roles within the Cossack movement and how they organize themselves constitutionally. And of course, naturally, we will deal with the constitutional monarch of the Cossacks, known either as the Ataman or the Hetman. The Hetman is the constitutional monarch of the Cossacks. Some are more powerful than others. Powerful leaders like Mazepa and Khmelnytsky rule very much as absolute monarchs, especially during times of warfare. And some wanted a hereditary monarchy. The Hetman is the commander-in-chief of the Cossack military forces. And you have, which shouldn't really surprise anybody, you have a great degree of aristocratic opposition to the growing authority of the Hetman, and the Hetman as a leader and hero of the Cossack forces. And it shouldn't surprise any of you that both Polish and Russian agents are involved in raising up rebellions of the aristocracy against the Hetmanate. And, in fact, many of the aristocrats of the Cossack forces will ally themselves with Moscow precisely because they don't want to be overshadowed by the power of the Hetmanate. there is another trend within the Hetman, and that is the idea of Sabona Pravan again, the idea that while the Hetman is very powerful, it can never function without or outside of the two councils that we have mentioned, the Council of Elders and the General Synod of the Cossack Forces. Now, the General Council itself is comprised of townsmen as well as clergy. It is based on class, and then in general, your upper class Cossacks dominate the council. And that its procedures, for the most part, are relatively loose. There really is no normal parliamentary procedure here. It's really just a matter of registering one's opinion given the circumstances. And, you know, like everything, you know, in terms of Slavic parliamentarism, it can be very violent. It can be very difficult to maintain. But secondly is the Council of Elders. And as I said before, this is something like an upper class in terms of the Cossack organization. These are elders, literally. These are men who have been on many campaigns. These are men of great wisdom, of great Orthodox piety. And they are advisors largely to the Hetman as well as to the General Council of Cossacks. They are organized in terms of Sobona Pravanya. They do view themselves as a council, as a sobor. And they are mentioned explicitly in the Benderi Constitution. Furthermore, the Council of Elders takes over where there is no Hetman. When the Hetman is killed or when one is not elected yet, the Council of Elders comes in and will take over for the role of the Hetman. So the Council of Elders is an immensely powerful institution, not so much from the point of view of institutional power, but from the point of view of their authority as veterans, as soldiers who have survived many, many campaigns. And so the Council of Elders, as well as the General Council of Cossacks, serve as a legislative check on the power of the Hetman, with the exception of times of warfare. I will say that the Council of Elders does function in times of warfare, because these are the men who have been through many campaigns. And you must heed their opinion in terms of warfare, in terms of their experience. Now, all of that being said, there is a central administration. And I want to hold that the central administration is very loose. Cossacks do not believe in bureaucracy, but they do believe in organization such that is necessary, particularly when you're under attack and when you are constantly under siege. The central administration derives, of course, like everything in the Cossack world, from military officers. And there really is no clear demarcation of officers. Different military officers might take on certain portfolios. There really is no cabinet. There is no set of set portfolio like you might have in European governments of today. It is kind of a rough and ready central organization of your most experienced fighters. But within the central administration, there are three particularly important people. Number one, there is the camp commander. The camp commander is, for lack of a better phrase, the deputy of the Hetman. He is the second person under the Hetman's authority. Number two, there is the adjudicator general, or the judge general, and he deals with court issues, both in terms of courts martial as well as civilian courts. Lastly, there is the Secretary General, who manages this bureaucracy as such. And he is really the officer that is meant to try to hold this, you know, kind of rough and ready cabinet together. So what do we have? We have a very loosely organized bureaucracy. We have a Cossack force that does not want to become a state in the modern sense of the term, and yet is forced to adopt certain elements of state power for no other reason than that they are under regular attack, that they are under, that they are constantly being involved in campaigns, and there's really not much they could do about that. They have to organize themselves in some kind of rational, society in order to organize themselves against their enemies, whether it be Russians, Poles, Turks, even Swedes later on. But those three people, the camp commander, the judge general, and the secretary general, all of these function in such a way as to create some kind of order within this rough and ready bureaucracy. So, again, as far as bureaucracy is concerned, the Cossacks could have done a lot worse. And I'm willing to say that the Cossacks lasted as long as they did, were as powerful as they were, partially because they refused to be pinned down by bureaucratic procedure. And I also want to say that it is the Russian Tsardom, specifically the Russian Tsardom of Catherine II, whose agents infiltrated the Cossack forces with one purpose, and that is to exploit the class differences between and among the Cossack elements. The rich Cossacks would be given Russian titles, and they would never have to worry about any kind of rebellion about the mid-level or poor-level Cossacks. And this is one of the things, this greed that that ended up destroying the Cossack forces, their autonomy, until the very end of the 18th century, where under Catherine the Great, they are officially abolished as an autonomous part of a Slavic Orthodox society. And it's a time of great mourning, because the modern state, with its surveillance, its spies, its high taxes, its huge armies, its forced labor, all of this is slowly taking over, and entities that sought to resist that, like the Cossacks, are fading. And they're fading because of greed. They're fading because of the ability of Russian agents and even Polish agents to exploit the class distinctions among the Cossack units. So let's finish up with all of this when we get back. I'm really hoping that I'm trying to really delegitimize the concept of the state here, and show the Cossacks as a kind of alternative state organization. So I'm trying to be as provocative here as possible, and I want you guys to understand what we have lost by the destruction of Cossack autonomy under Catherine the Great. So hang in there, my friends. We will be back in just a minute.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to this edition of the Orthodox Medievalist. This is my birthday edition. I turned 38 today, 10/18/71. I am celebrating this the best way I know how. In fact, the only way I know how, talking about the Cossacks. What could be a better way to celebrate one's birthday than to talk about the Cossacks? I am at a loss. There really is no way, if you ask me. So, what we've been talking about today is the organization of the Cossack forces. The Cossacks have been a source of a lot of questions and a lot of issues and a lot of admiration over the years, without really a lot of functional knowledge in terms of how they functioned and how they organized themselves, specifically after the rebellions of Khmelnytsky and Mazepa, which we have spoken about in previous programs. So, for the rest of the program, we're going to be dealing with four topics: the local administration, the towns, the peasants, and the court system. And I'm kind of hoping that maybe we can consider how we can reform our own system by understanding how the Cossacks functioned and how their own system functioned. We know that it worked. We know the Cossacks, at least according to Leo Tolstoy and many others, were a very, very happy people. They were a people who loved to party. They were a people who enjoyed the camaraderie and brotherhood that came with this kind of military valor, but a military valor that was orthodox at its root and dedicated to protecting their national independence and freeing Christian slaves from the Turks and from other Muslims and pagans throughout that part of the world. I also want to mention, while I'm thinking about it, I'm not on the computer that much, so I never get a chance to read the comments made about me on the blog that I know exists at the Voice of Reason, or really any other blog that's out there. So I'll ask my friends as well as my enemies to please contact me at FatherRaphael@yahoo.com. I'm pretty sure that address is on the website of a Voice of Reason somewhere. And so if there are any questions or comments, please contact me directly, and we could talk about it one-on-one. I would appreciate that. More than just having these kind of anonymous comments. I'm not really big into the blog stuff. I never quite understood it. And I don't care. But please, if there's a compliment or a problem or a question or an issue, go to my email address and email me directly, and I'll try to get back to you, as soon as possible. I only use the computer when absolutely necessary. And by the way, I recommend that to all my listeners as well. Okay, so in terms of local administration, the Cossack units existed in every major Ukrainian town. You know, Kherson and Bratislava, Podila, all of these places had Cossack detachments. Most of the time, these detachments and their administration were elected by the local Ukrainian people, but on occasion, they could be appointed by the local colonel. And I want you guys to remember, and it's very important, that the colonels that we talked about before, the colonel is an independent entity under the hetman that exists in a very decentralized conciliar system throughout Ukraine, under the nominal control of the hetman. The fact is, though, that the colonel is fully independent. This is the nature. We've been talking about this over and over again. We've used the word subordinate pravanya. This is the idea of the rule of the council from the bottom up, making the most important decisions. And the colonels that existed under the Hetman were fully independent, and all functions, economic and judicial, came under him at the local level. But the colonel was also assisted by the regimental council. We talked about the nature of the Cossack, the organization of the Cossack armed units. And I'll repeat, you know, at its height, you had maybe a quarter of a million Cossack soldiers organized in regiments of roughly 5,000 people, 5,000 warriors, and then you had centurions, each of which under roughly 100 people, maybe a quarter of all of that are infantry. As most of you know, overwhelmingly, the Cossacks were horsemen. And the Cossacks relied overwhelmingly on the equine way of fighting rather than fighting on two legs. So while the colonel is independent of the hetman, the colonel is not independent of the regiment. And the regiment is there, the regimental council or sobor is there to assist the colonel in his various duties, economic, political, military, and judicial. And again, here's another area where the Russians sought to eliminate this kind of collaboration. And I'll say this again and again and again, probably for the rest of my life. But instead of having a brotherly connection between the Russian Empire and the Cossacks, using the Cossacks as an orthodox force against the enemies of Russia, the Russians, especially under Catherine the Great, use the Cossacks, I should say Peter the Great too, of course. Use the Cossacks as forced labor. Use them as border guards. Gave them very little in return and slowly but surely eliminated every little bit of autonomy from these people. You know, I mean, this is a very serious problem in Russian history. Had the Cossacks been able to expand and run the country and run, you know, southern Russia and Ukraine this way, could the revolution have ever succeeded? It's this hyper-centralization in St. Petersburg, this bureaucracy that had nothing to do with the common people. This has everything to do with what will eventually come to overthrow the Russian Empire. And yet the Cossacks functioned exactly in the opposite way. Everything was from the bottom up. No one was left out. It was democratic, not in the liberal sense, but it was democratic in the military and Christian sense. It spoke to the Russian heart, for lack of a better phrase. And that's why it's no accident that throughout Russian history, up until Catherine the Great, the great rebellions against Tsarist rule were led and controlled by the Cossack forces, from Razin under Tsar Alexis to Pugachev under Catherine II. They all fought for the same thing. They all fought for the same kind of governmental structure, which frankly I think could have survived World War I and could have created almost a universal Orthodox Empire. But instead of that, the Russians, in their ham-handed way from St. Petersburg, did everything they could to subvert this system. In addition to that, the towns. Remember, towns are areas of trade. And according to the Magdeburg laws that the Ukrainian towns are under, they are purely independent and self-governing. They are not under the Cossack system so long as they pay their taxes, which are very low. So long as they pay their taxes and remain loyal, they are completely independent. They are completely self-governing. They are the economic centers of the Cossack world. But here's the problem. here's the rub. Here's what's going to destroy all of this, and that's the treatment of the peasants. Every czar from Peter the Great to Catherine, with the possible exception of Elizabeth. Elizabeth is not a bad woman, and in fact, Elizabeth is worth a show in and of herself. But the upper-level Cossacks demanded the same privileges in Ukraine that Russian nobles had in Russia. And the main privilege that they had was the owning of serfs. And so the Cossack gentry demanded serfs, and they received serfs. So now the Cossacks, these great fighters for liberty, became no different than the arrogant, westernized Russian gentry who controlled serfs as if they were cattle. Within Cossack territory, you had villages that were strictly military. They were peasants, but they were trained in the martial arts, and they knew how to defend themselves. But slowly but surely, these villages were brought to the level of serf villages. I mean, this is the outrage. I mean, you could have had a thriving military village life. A life of villagers who knew how to defend themselves, who were masters of military tactics. They could go out into the fields or they could herd their cattle and yet defend themselves no better or worse than any soldier in any part of the world. And yet the demands of the upper level of upper levels of the Cossacks, through the manipulation of agents of the crown, of the two Annas and Catherine, reduced these villages to serfs. What a disaster! What an absolute disaster for Russia this was. And how few textbooks, if any textbooks, will even talk about this transition as having anything to do with the eventual overthrow of the Russian Empire. Or at the very least, the weakening of the Russian Empire. The rest of the villages in Ukraine, slowly but surely, were brought under the reign of serfdom. And lastly, the court system. Basically, the way that the courts functioned is the same way that the remainder of the Cossack society functioned. There were the courts under the hetman, under the colonels, under the regiments, and within the military villages. And that made a lot of sense. What you had really in the court system was this overlapping of military, class, and political issues, all wrapped up with economic questions within the Cossack universe, which is to be expected, given the fact that this world is always under attack. Now, the colonels and the regimental captains normally did not oversee these courts. These courts were overseen by underlings, by those that the colonels and regimental heads had appointed as head of the court system. It was a bad system. It failed. And I want to make the claim that because you had so many miscarriages of justice under the Cossack court system, you had complaints that found their way to the court of Peter the Great and his successors. All that meant is now that Peter and his successors had yet another excuse to intervene in Ukrainian affairs. The Cossacks represent for us, they represent an alternative to the state. They represent a proud military branch of knights, and they refer to themselves as knights. And yet, because of greed, because of class division, because of foreign intrigue, they were subjected to the Russian government under Catherine the Great and eventually destroyed. And they became, unfortunately, little more than law enforcement officials of the czarist world. But that is not what they were. The Cossacks are heroes. The Cossacks are those people who organized to defend the Christian faith, to rescue Christian slaves, to disrupt the economic world of the enemies of Christian society. They represented a different view of solidarity, a different view of economic life. They loved their friendship and their partying and their holy days and their fast days. And I strongly recommend you read Leo Tolstoy's The Cossacks, which is a short but brilliant novel that tells you a lot about how the Cossacks lived. But I'm here to tell you that this libertarian, nationalist, and Christian movement was destroyed and how they were destroyed. And it's something for us to be frightened of, to be sad of. I don't really see it being any different in its essence than how our agrarian American states were eventually turned into appendages of Washington, D.C. This happens over and over and over again. And what we as revolutionaries need to do is to reinvigorate this idea, to reinvigorate the Cossack idea of rebellion. When I read about the rebellion of Razin or Pugachev, I see nothing different than the Whiskey Rebellion in America, or Shays Rebellion, or Freeze Rebellion in America. I see one in the same struggle. Anyway, I'm out of time, and I want to thank my friends at the Voice of Reason, Mike and Steve and Dietrich and everybody else for helping me out here. I want to thank all my listeners. And I hope that I'm able in some small way to contribute to, especially in these rotten economic times, to the building of a nationalist Christian revolutionary movement. So I beg of the blessing of the Lord God and Savior Jesus Christ on all of you. And until next time, hang in there. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Radio 8.